Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry is at the controls. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon. We have 10 different topics throughout the week. If you'd like to get a look at the schedule for next week, listen to some past programs on our audio archive, or perhaps sign up for our podcast. You can do any and all of that, including getting more information on all of the shows that we broadcast on WILL radio and TV. You can do all of that by looking at our website, which is WILL. That's Will, WILL.illinois.edu. After 9/11, the Bush administration declared that the United States was at war. But they said that this war wouldn't be like past wars, and it would require a new way of thinking, and that would result in the most radical remaking of America's notion of justice in generations. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Eric Lischblau about his book, Bush's Law. The subtitle is The Remaking of American Justice. The book is published by Pantheon, and among other things, it details the administration's warrantless wiretapping program and the intense pressure that was brought to bear on the New York Times newspaper to block publication of a story about that program. Our guest, Eric Lischblau, received the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for his stories on the National Security Agency's wiretapping program. He's worked in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, covering the Justice Department since 2002, and before that, from 1999 until 2002, he covered the Justice Department for the Los Angeles Times. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome. We ask only that people try to keep their questions brief so we can keep moving along. But anyone who is welcome, who is listening, is welcome to call, join the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, all you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. Mr. Lischblau, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and yourself?
Good, good.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate
it. Thanks for having
me. It must be interesting, when you think about how being on this beat changed, how covering the Justice Department, what it would have been like, say, before 9/11 and what it's been like since. I expect it's a very different kind of job.
Oh, it changed dramatically. I mean, before 9/11, there were, really a wide range of issues that we covered day in and day out that have really gotten short shrift or no shrift at all after 9/11. You know, since 2001, it's been all terrorism pretty much 24/7 on the National Security and Justice Department beats, and it's changed the whole nature of the way we cover Washington.
Yeah, clearly here, when you think about the realities of 9/11, here this administration faced a horrible situation and also a huge challenge, and that would have been that way for anybody. It wouldn't have mattered what party the person came from.
I agree.
A horrible situation and a huge challenge. And they said to themselves, they said to the American people, we're going to do everything we can to prevent another attack. And now a lot of people would raise many questions about what it was that they did in response. But if you just put yourself in that particular situation, that is the situation the administration was in, do you have any sympathy at all for them and that challenge that they faced?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the themes of my book, is that I think that the immediate response to 9/11 was probably no different from the Bush administration than it would have been from an Al Gore administration had he been elected, or any administration, Democratic or Republican, at least in the early months and year or two after 9/11. I think there was national outrage and really shock over the fact that the United States had been attacked so boldly from 19 hijackers who had been hiding in our own country. Where many people, even within the administration, believe that the White House went off course was in its really disdain, and I know that's a strong word, but it was disdain for bringing in Congress, for engaging the courts and international allies, and the public for that matter, in any discourse a year or two after 9/11, once we had escaped the second wave that everyone here in Washington thought was coming. Everyone believed that there would likely be another attack from 9/11. We escaped that. There was no attempt, really, by the White House to sort of take a breath, to take a step back and say, okay, well, what do we do now? Do we operate in this permanent state of war forever, in this intense mode of secrecy and executive power without any checks and balances? And the answer from the White House was clearly yes, that this was a permanent state of war, and that was a position that I think made even senior officials within the administration, many of whom I talked to, uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is something here that I think is very clear and certainly emerges from the book. That is that virtually from the beginning here, there were people within the administration who were questioning the tactics that the administration was putting into place. And also what was happening, though, was that anyone who did question those tactics or stood up and said something like, look, let's not forget here civil liberties. Civil liberties matter. People like that, even within the administration, were accused of siding with the enemy. And it seemed that quite from the very beginning, there was this philosophy. It was the with us, either you're with us or against us. And even people who were in the administration were targets.
Right, right. Those people were quickly sidelined or silenced altogether, and that's a phenomenon that we saw literally from the first hours after 9/11. I tell the story, in fact, it's the opening chapter of my book, about the head of the Immigration and Naturalization Service who was in the FBI command center and was aghast at some of the tactics he was hearing that were being discussed at the Justice Department in terms of door-to-door sweeps of Muslim neighborhoods, questioning and perhaps detention of people with Middle Eastern backgrounds, and the INS commissioner, and this was Jim Ziegler at that time, who was a conservative through and through, a Barry Goldwater conservative, stood up during this fairly dramatic moment on the day of 9/11 and said that the INS would not be participating in this, and that what was being suggested was more like the British monarchy in colonial America in terms of executing general warrants without any reason to think that anyone had done anything wrong. And that really was the opening salvo, as I tell it in the book, in what would be really run-in after run-in. It's important, as you suggest, I think, in your question, these were not run-ins between, you know, the Bush White House and the ACLU. Mm-hmm. These were run-ins between conservatives and conservatives over just how far executive power could go. And, of course, we saw that most dramatically in the National Security Agency's wiretapping program. That became eventually a full-scale rebellion within the Justice Department in 2004 over whether or not the president had the power, had the constitutional and the legal power to wiretap Americans without a warrant.
You know, given the fact that there were these conflicts within the administration involving other conservative Republicans, and the fact that people like that could be, you know, their patriotism, their commitment to the war on terror could be questioned if they raised questions about civil liberties. Where did that place people like you? Where did that place reporters who were trying to cover this story?
Well, we certainly had our own patriotism challenged in writing about the NSA story. The paper, as your listeners may know, held off for more than a year in publishing our story because of, you know, very real concerns about the effect on national security. Ultimately, we did publish that story in December of 2005. And there was a furious response from both sides, really, but from the right, you know, we were accused of treasonous acts, of traitorous acts that would help Al-Qaeda. Our editor at one point in a follow-up story that we did, there was a blogger on the right wing who suggested that he should be sent to the gas chamber. You know, these were emotional, difficult issues, and the press was caught in the middle. I make the lay out the case in my book that in those first 2 years after 9/11, the press was much more passive than it traditionally had been, that we were not really asking the tough skeptical questions that we are trained to ask, and the administration really got off pretty easy in those first couple of years in 2002 and 2003 without any real close scrutiny of the way this war on terror was being waged. All the focus was on the enemy, was on Al-Qaeda, was on whether or not we were going to be attacked again. And obviously that was and is a very legitimate focus, but there was very little scrutiny on how we were going about trying to stop the next attack and what impact that might have on just democratic and legal procedures. And it wasn't really until 2004 with the Abu Ghraib scandal, for instance, and stories out of Guantanamo Bay and stories about CIA secret prisons and of course, NSA wiretapping, that the media really began to kind of revert to its old ways of asking tough questions.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Eric Lischblau. He works for the New York Times and their Washington Bureau covering the Justice Department and has since 2002. Before that, he covered the Justice Department for the Los Angeles Times. He received the Pulitzer Prize in 2006 for national reporting for his stories on the NSA's wiretapping program that, as he mentioned, were published in the paper. He's also authored a recently published book that's titled Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice, and it's published by Pantheon. Questions, welcome. Here, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. In the effort to find terrorists here in the United States after 9/11, do we know how many people, altogether, how many people were arrested?
I give a figure worldwide of about 2,700, which I'm sure is a very conservative estimate. Within the U.S., in the immediate aftermath, there were upwards of about 1,100 people, most of them illegal immigrants, who were arrested as terrorism suspects, even though, as it would turn out, virtually none of them, you could even make the case that literally none of them, had any ties to terrorism, yet they were held indefinitely, often for months at a time, as terrorism suspects. And we saw that same phenomenon, obviously, at Guantanamo Bay with suspects who were subjected to renditions overseas. The number is certainly in the thousands, but at a minimum, 2,700.
And aside from those people who are at Guantanamo, of these people who were arrested in the immediate period after 9/11, are there people who are still being held?
Well, you're talking about within the U.S. civil system,
yes. Certainly
there are a number of people, several dozen or so, who have been charged and convicted in terrorism cases. These become difficult to count, but it's probably about 100 cases total. The Lackawanna Six, you may remember, was one of the first big ones. John Walker Lind was also a huge one early on. There was a group in Portland. So certainly there are anywhere from probably 50 to 100 people who are now in prison who have gone through the civil court process, been charged and convicted. There have also been many, many more than that who are originally charged and implicated on what were described as terrorism charges, who in the end were not convicted of anything at all or perhaps were convicted on much different charges, immigration fraud or things like that had nothing to do with terrorism. Some of these cases have become kind of famous failures for the Justice Department. There was a case probably about 7 or 8 months ago in Texas, where the Holy Land Foundation, a large Islamic charity, a whole group of its leaders were charged with several hundred criminal counts of supporting terrorist financing, and the Justice Department was unable to get a single conviction in that case. There's a more recent case in Miami involving a group that supposedly was trying to bring down the Sears Tower. there. The Justice Department is now on its third try to get a single conviction there. So the record has been very, very spotty.
So again, out of this, around the world, something like 2,700 people who were suspected of somehow being involved in terrorism were arrested in the United States, maybe about 1,100. And out of all those people, we have, well, fewer than 100.
I would say that those are difficult numbers to gauge, but there was a study just out that said that there were about 107 real terrorism cases, as opposed to much bigger numbers that were counted as terrorism and really weren't.
We have a caller here to talk with. Let's do that. Someone in
sure.
Bloomington, first caller is in Bloomington, Illinois, and that's on line number one. Hello.
Hi, Mr. Lishbaum?
Yes.
Yes, how you doing today?
Good, how are you?
Hey, I was wondering, what was your relationship with Judith Miller, and then how do you feel her role played at the New York Times as far as perpetuating the Bush administration's war on terror?
Well, I worked with Judy on a number of Al-Qaeda stories after 9/11 and did not work on any stories really involving the build-up to the war in Iraq. Certainly that was a difficult period for the newspaper. The papers acknowledged that there were that there were stories that should have been written differently, that should have been played differently. My personal feeling, and Judy, you know, I consider her a friend. I visited her when she was in jail. My personal feeling is that she's been overly vilified for what were shortcomings by many, many people in the media. And, you know, as Scott McClellan has just acknowledged in his book, this was, you know, a White House that was intentionally trying to mislead the media. So I think to pin, you know, all the errors in coverage on one reporter is a bit unfair.
Okay.
All right.
All right, thank you very much.
Let's go on to another caller here. This is Champaign County, line number two. Hello.
Hi, yeah, I'm more worried about Michael Garden, who is still writing and is serving a similar purpose vis-a-vis Iran. But I've been wading through the book. I confess I haven't read your book. I've read articles. But there's a new book out called Spies for Hire, which goes into the murky story of how this was done, basically, how TIA, Total Information Awareness, which was contracted out. It seems incredibly pernicious to democracy because you can do freedom of information. You can get sources in the government, but the contractors, the biggest contractor to the NSA is SAIC, which has a presence in the research park on the U of I campus here. It's extremely distressing. I just heard a figure that probably 1,000 individuals were spied on through this. There's no way of really judging it. I don't know whether you'd want to hazard a guess, but how do you feel about the capitulation by the Democrats? Apparently it's been held up in the Senate, but it's an unrelated issue. It's somebody who wants to tag on something on a must-pass bill. It seems to me, leading up to the 4th of July weekend, that there should be a general uprising. People say that there's a 60% approval rating in some way, but I can't believe that that's not affected by the questions, the way the questions is asked. And I'm sorry for not asking a real question, but if you would reflect on this personally.
Well, I guess I'll tackle the end part of your comment or question. You're referring there to the surveillance legislation that's now pending in the Senate, I believe. And just to update your listeners there, there is a vote that we're expecting any day in the Senate. The bill has already been approved by the House, and the main elements of that are, in some key ways, expanding the NSA's surveillance power and probably the key element for the White House that they've one in concessions from the Democrats is giving immunity to the telephone companies, AT&T and Verizon, and others that took part in the warrantless wiretapping program. Those companies are now facing a whole barrage of lawsuits, more than 40 that are consolidated out in California. And if and when this legislation passes, and it seems all but certain that it will pass the Senate, probably right after July 4th. Then the lawsuits would almost certainly be thrown out. You use the word capitulation. I mean, that's a judgment that some people have have made, and I won't weigh in on that, but what has happened is that the Democrats certainly held their ground to a surprising degree against the White House for about 5 months, to the point that they allowed a previous bill, a temporary surveillance bill, to actually expire. And of course, that led to a whole hue and cry from the White House announcing that national security was being endangered by the Democrats. And we've had this standoff, really, for 5 months, surprising a lot of people, because this is really the first time that the Democrats had stood their ground on an issue where the White House was sort of playing that national security card. In the end, now, the White House, just in the last few days, has essentially gotten most of what it's wanted. In fact, in the view of some Republicans, it got even more than it wanted in this bill. And as I said, the Senate will vote on that probably right after July 4th. There are a couple of folks on the left for the Democratic Party who are trying to hold it up, mostly Senator Feingold. But clearly, the Democrats don't have the votes to stop it.
Don't you think that the bigger thing at stake here is not just the telecoms, but this whole apparatus of private analysts? I mean, people get bumped out of the administration, Boykins and a variety of other peaks, Camboni, get bumped out, and then they do the same job in the private sector. And it seems to me that the tip of the iceberg is the telecoms that directly provided the taps, but there's all these other firms. It's incredible.
Well, you're right. Certainly, the private sector has taken on a bigger and bigger role the last 10 or 15 years as sort of a private intelligence service through a whole host of companies, private contractors, and that does raise a whole host of issues as far as accountability. As you said, whereas we have these limited access sometimes to what the government is doing, we have virtually none to companies like, as you mentioned, one SAIC and other companies where this is being farmed out to them, outsourced to companies that are now in the private intelligence business.
Okay, thank you.
We're at our midpoint here, and I have a couple of callers. The story here that we're alluding to is probably, of all of the things that you're writing about in the book, it's the biggest story and the one for which you won the Pulitzer Prize, this controversy over surveillance being carried out without benefit of warrants by the National Security Agency, monitoring various kind of communications involving one party that might be outside of the United States, but also another party inside. And
right.
The administration said, well, because one of these parties is outside the United States, that qualifies as foreign intelligence gathering. But the question was, well, yeah, but you're also doing surveillance of people inside the United States. You don't have a warrant. It's not part of the NSA mandate. So you shouldn't be doing this. Let's just, for people who aren't really quite sure what this was all about, just maybe you'd better give us the basics.
Sure. There was a law passed in 1978 in the wake of the Watergate abuses that regulated how the president could go about collecting foreign intelligence for terrorism investigations, for espionage investigations, and that set up a court known as the FISA Court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, which required that all wiretaps that were targeting Americans, even if one end might be outside the United States, had to go through this court. And what happened after 9/11 was that this was really spearheaded by Vice President Cheney. The White House made the decision that it had in its view, the constitutional authority to act outside the court system and could target what we believe to be hundreds or thousands of Americans in terms of their international communications without going through the court system. It's cited as the legal authority for that, both its commander-in-chief powers under the Constitution and also measure that was passed by Congress a few days after 9/11 called the Authorization to Use Military Force Against Al-Qaeda. And the White House came back and said, well, they authorized us to use military force, and wiretapping is a key component of the military force. Now, that's an argument that's been sort of ridiculed by members of Congress who said, wait a second, we never intended for you to be able to do this when we voted for you to basically go into Afghanistan. And there's been, you know, a legal uproar now for 2.5 years over this program since we first disclosed it in the paper. We had one judge who in Detroit, in fact, who declared it unconstitutional and illegal. We had appellate courts then who threw that out because it's tough for anyone to really show that they were wiretapped. Now, finally, Congress is going to resolve the issue and by all indications, is going to resolve it in favor of the White House.
The paper reported this story, ran the story in December 2005.
Right.
At that point, how long had you and the people at the Times actually been aware of the fact that the government was doing this?
Well, the editors made the decision about a year earlier in November 2004 to hold the story, meaning that it would not run. The White House made an impassioned appeal to the top editors, the very top editors of the paper, not to run the story on national security grounds, saying that basically Americans would die if we ran the story. And you know, any editor is gonna think very, very hard about that. I believed, and my partner on the story, Jim Risen, believed that the story could run without compromising national security, and that there were serious legal issues that the public had a right to know about. The editors make those calls. That's why they're the editors. And they were not comfortable at that early point running the story. And it wasn't until a year later when the legal issues became even clearer, and by that I mean that the anxiety within the administration, which we began hearing about a year earlier, became even more apparent. That this was a program that was causing, really extreme nervousness within the White House, within the administration, about whether or not it was legal. And I think that was ultimately the issue that sort of tipped the scales for the editors in saying, you know what, we feel like we can run this story. Mm.
Aside from the administration saying, look, we think that this is national security will be compromised if the paper runs this story, we think that people might die, other than making that kind of argument, did the administration do anything else to try to prevent the Times from running this story?
Well, they offered more detailed arguments than that, and some of those I even now have not gotten into because it does involve potentially sensitive material. But they offered a detailed and impassioned argument. In the end, what I learned they were thinking about doing was to seek an injunction, like as was done 30 years before in the Pentagon Papers. There was consideration of going to court to actually stop publication once the paper decided it was going to run the story, and my learning that had the effect of getting the paper to post it on the internet the night before it actually ran on the paper, because unlike in 1971 when the Pentagon Papers ran, we had the advantage of putting something out on the internet, and you know, they couldn't stop the presses even if they wanted to. You know, once it was out there, it was out there.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. We have some other callers, and we'll get to them in just a moment. Just as soon as I introduce again our guest, Eric Lischblau. He works for the New York Times. He's in their Washington Bureau. He covers the Justice Department and has since 2002. Before that, he had the same beat. He covered the Justice Department for the Los Angeles Times. He received the Pulitzer Prize in 2006 for national reporting for his stories on the NSA's wiretapping program. He is the author of the recently published book, Bush's Law, The Remake of American Justice, published by Pantheon. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have someone calling from Will County. Next is in line, and this is our toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Howdy.
Yes.
How are you this morning?
Good.
Hi there.
There have been a number of books now, yours included, on the subject of, let's say, Bush's Law, this imaginative fantasy about powers that the executive may deploy, and it seemed that the White House was 100% in favor of trying whatever they could make up. for us who read these books, that's all well and good. But I'm afraid they may not have any effect on the status of constitutional law. One of the books, book writers who was recently interviewed talked about the ratchet effect, saying that the powers that the administration has glommed on this time around are likely to be preserved in the next administration, whatever flavor it is, just because the party in power finds the new opportunities useful. My question is there anybody on the political scene, from Feingold or Dangle or somebody, who can actually make or is actually making a political or campaign case that we need to crank back Bush's law? Is there somebody? I don't hear it from either the presidential candidate. I've had ears cocked for 6 months for somebody to say something as clear as the administration has taken liberties with the notion of the executive and with constitutional law. My plan is to crank that back. So I haven't heard that person. Have you? Who would it be?
Well, Obama did sound that theme for a while in his campaign, although interestingly, when it came to this vote now before the Senate on whether to give immunity to the phone companies to expand the NSA's powers, he now is saying that he will vote for that bill, which is a reversal for him, I think, is sort of facing the political realities. And I think your initial point is a valid one, that whoever ends up in the White House is likely to assume whatever powers their predecessor, Bush, claimed for them. The first task and the first priority of either President McCain or President Obama is going to be to stop another terrorist attack. No one is going to want that on their watch. And I think it's going to be difficult to say, you know, George Bush assumed these more expansive powers, and now I'm going to give some of them back in the name of principle. I think it's likely that in the absence of Congress acting, that those powers will continue, for better or worse. And I don't cast judgment on whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. The White House has succeeded in, for the most part, holding on to a lot of the powers that it's assumed. Now it has had several setbacks in the courts. Just recently, a few weeks ago, with the case in Guantanamo, where the court effectively said that the detainees have the right to habeas corpus and have the right to appeal their why they're there in the first place. But that said, the basic structure of the counterterrorism policies remains in effect. We just had a hearing on Capitol Hill yesterday with a couple of the key architects defending it, David Addington,
right,
Vice President Cheney's office, right, and John Yoo, who was one of the key lawyers. So I don't know that you're going to see any enormous shift as you seem to be hoping for.
Well, the Addington Yoo sort of brand of legal theory has been speculative from the get-go. People who've looked at it carefully have written any number of books that say these powers don't exist. We've operated as if they do, and only persisted doing so for lack of oversight in Congress. Are you saying that the next administration would like to take what's given and use it for the best, and therefore the only remedy is a Congress that will enforce its oversight privileges to draw a bright line between what executive powers are and what they're not?
Congressional oversight is certainly a key part of it. The Democrats have been more aggressive in that way, certainly, than the Republicans had. But as we see now on this wiretapping issue, they took it so far, and then in the end,
yeah,
seemed to have essentially yielded to the White House.
Right, capitulating is a strong word. I'd use the word caving. But if it One last question. If it's not Congress, what about the fourth branch? We recognize that Congress was asleep for a couple of years, and you admitted the press didn't do its best for a couple of years. Is there an opportunity for writers like you and so on to actually show the bright line and say, this is the kind of thing that this is the kind of administration we should be looking for, and doing your part to track the candidates to see how they match or repudiate the prior administration?
Well, sure, and I'd argue that, that we are doing that. And for the last few years, most of the issues that we're now that we're now debating are being talked about because they were first disclosed in the media. A lot of these programs and operations would still remain secret if it weren't for the media. So I think the media has has stepped up to the plate in the last 3 or 4 years and provided that kind of public oversight that you think is missing from Congress. Mm-hmm.
Again, I want to thank the caller and get some others. Just real quick, I want to be clear about something. In making the decision to do an end run around FISA, to ignore the requirement that you're supposed to go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and get the authorization to do the surveillance, whose decision was it ultimately to do this?
Well, it was ultimately President Bush's decision. I mean, he has taken responsibility for that. But the architect of it was clearly Vice President Cheney. He was the one that set that process in motion. Talking to the leaders of the NSA and the CIA at the time, when they briefed a very, very small number, a limited number of members of Congress. At first, it was only four. They did it in Cheney's office under super secret conditions, where members were not allowed to take notes, were not allowed to talk to their attorneys. It was Cheney's vision of basically empowering a White House that he thought had been left weakened by the reforms of the Watergate era. And he then took that decision to President Bush himself.
And their justification basically was that they felt that they had been granted sweeping powers by Congress in granting them the authority to essentially do anything. That's the way they were reading it, to deal with the terrorist threat against the United States.
Yeah, their legal arguments, as I referred to earlier, were twofold. That first of all, in the Constitution, Article 2 of the Constitution, giving the president power as commander-in-chief to defend the country, and that Congress cannot do anything to take away that power. And second of all, that this this act that was passed by Congress just a few days after 9/11, the authorization to use military force, which was essentially the green light to invade Afghanistan, also allowed them to do anything it took to combat al-Qaeda, whether that meant detaining prisoners in Guantanamo or wiretapping Americans. That was a broad argument, which, as I said, has been met with a lot of skepticism by some members of Congress who actually voted for it.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Eric Lischblau. He's a reporter for the New York Times. He covers the Justice Department. He's the author of the book, Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. It's published by Pantheon. The next caller is in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. The telecom immunity brings up a more general issue of outsourcing of intelligence gathering. I was wondering if the immunity that's being discussed for the telecom companies would also apply to any private entity that was doing intelligence gathering for the government, or if that immunity already exists.
Well, it's an interesting question, and I've looked into that a bit myself. As far as we can tell, it applies only to the telecom companies that were actually facilitating these wiretaps. It does not carry a broader immunity. There are certainly other statutes that give legal protection, but as best we can tell, it applies only to the telecom companies themselves.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Next, we go to someone, I believe, in Seneca. This is our line number one. Hello.
Hi, Tony.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, this is interesting conversation, although I kind of disagree and I kind of agree. I'm kind of 50-50 on this. Now, the reason I say this is because everybody wants to blame Bush. I'm not a Bush supporter, but, and I get tired of this, Bush bashing on everything that's out there. If I go to the bathroom tomorrow, I'm, you know, it's basically you're going to blame Bush for that, if it doesn't turn out right. The point I'm bringing out, and maybe that's a crude way of putting it, but I agree that there's some over an abundance about the security thing. But people also have to understand, the media should not have security, clearance on everything 100% of the time. That's the one thing I'm dead set against. Having grown up in a military family, having spent most of my time in military spots, I can tell you right now, some people right now are going overboard. Basically, they have too much information. They're giving away spots. Let me ask you this. As a reporter, your job is to go out there and get the story, right?
Sure.
Okay. No matter what it takes, you're going to get the story, right?
There are limits, but
yeah. Yeah, there should be limits, but it doesn't seem to be. I know for a fact that there's been times where some of our troops in Iraq got nailed solely because a reporter or a group of reporters gave them the wherewithal where it's at. And, you know, okay, we're talking about security here and the clearances that George Bush is, you know. The bottom line is, I personally am dead set against some of the news media being involved in this war in Iraq in the first place. I think there ought to be one, maybe two, in a pool, go there and send the rest back home. And I think there'd be limitations. Now, as far as individuals and civilians, yeah, he did overstep his boundary. But there was a gentleman two callers ago who brought the fact up, where's this outcry from the Democrats? Because I firmly believe that they're just as ingrained in this as anybody else.
Let me just jump in here because we're really getting short on time and we're getting into often some other areas that maybe are sort of peripheral. But I guess I am interested in how you think about the fact that there is a line, or maybe there should be a line, or should there be a line that reporters should respect that has to do with national security.
And sure.
You think about the fact that publishing something could be problematic.
We think about that all the time. I think the fact that the paper, waited more than a year to publish this story is evidence of that. I talk in my book about a couple of instances where we came across programs and issues that we decided not to even pursue because they so clearly crossed that line, and we didn't think that there was really an outweighing public interest in even reporting them, much less running them. So I think they're the media is well aware of its responsibility in that area. And, you know, the question that I would ask your caller and all your listeners is, who do you want to make those decisions? Do you want an administration, which has been, in this case, an incredibly secretive administration and has classified millions and millions of documents, or do you want an independent press to make those decisions?
One more caller here, at least in Stell, line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I can't compact everything that I think about on this subject, but I'll go for it. I really want to acknowledge Mr. Lichbaugh, if that was his name, for mentioning in his opening remarks about how the 9/11 event so permanently impacted the media and maybe he said the national life. Mm-hmm. In my view, it so negatively impacted the national life. We can hardly think of anything nowadays except war. And then on the other hand, the economy, and we just bounce back and forth between those endlessly. And there's just so many things in national life that, in my view, have been cut out. I mean, I used to enjoy a lot of interesting programs on C-SPAN on different kinds of books other than war and the presidency, and now those seem to just not appear on the program. But It just seemed to me from the beginning that this administration was willing to lie between its teeth on everything or anything, as did Clinton before him, just to promote his own personal agenda. And to me, this could give lots of credence. This is my last point, lots of credence to people who say that it has been a conspiracy to take over national life. So that's essentially it.
Okay, appreciate your comments. I mean, if it has come to that, that's all we that's all we think about. I think that is a sad commentary. I agree.
Let me go back to another point, in a sense, to bounce off of what the earlier caller said, and I think it's this worth underscoring, because there are some people who have said that the kind of criticisms that some of our callers have raised and people have made, criticisms of the administration and what it's done in terms of law and civil liberty and justice, coming from Democrats or people on the left or so forth, I think it's worth underscoring, and as you do write in the book, that people within the administration, people, for example, like at the beginning you mentioned the guy who was the head of the Immigration and Naturalization Service and others, people who were good, solid, conservative Republicans in every respect, were looking at some of the things that the administration was doing and were saying, we should not be doing this.
Right.
So it was not just criticism coming from the left, from the media. It was also coming from the right. People were very worried about what the administration was doing.
Yeah, I think that's a crucial point, and I think probably the most unfortunate aspect about this whole debate is that a lot of these policies probably could have been carried out had they just been done in a different way, had there been more transparency and more checks and balances, had the administration been willing to work with Congress, to engage the courts, to work with the public, I think it could have accomplished many of the same things.
Well, then I suppose some people would ask if civil liberties were compromised, if things like what happened here happened, is this something that will somehow be carried on? Does that mean that's what things are going to be like from here on out? Have there been permanent changes in the way in which we think about these things?
Oh, I think we'll certainly be living with the reverberations of 9/11 and the aftermath for generations. Exactly how that will play out, I don't think anyone knows. But it was a life changing event for everyone, I think.
Well, and as far as the administration is concerned, they would argue, we all know that they have, we've heard them say in as many words, that the fact that there has not been another 9/11 style attack means that what the administration has been doing has worked.
Sure, and I give them credit in the book for taking a lot of steps that were certainly necessary and long overdue in terms of Homeland Defense, in terms of better coordination of intelligence, and those are things which in all likelihood have helped to prevent another attack. We don't know exactly how it is that it's been 7 years now. You ask 10 different counterterrorism experts, you'll get 10 different answers, but certainly some of those steps have helped to keep us safer.
Certainly there's been a lot of criticism as a result after 9/11, criticism of the United States and its intelligence gathering and law enforcement apparatus, particularly the FBI, that it had failed to get, I guess that's a great understatement, I suppose, that it had failed to gather enough information and interpret
sure.
it. Another problem was the inability, apparently, of agencies like the FBI and the CIA to work with one another. Would more data, better analysis have helped to prevent 9/11? Is it possible to answer a question like that?
I think that's really an open question. What is certain is that is now the current approach of the government. One of your earlier callers referred to the TIA, the Total Information Awareness System, which was an early program after 9/11 that was later scuttled because of congressional concerns. But what we now have, what we're now seeing with the NSA wiretapping program, with programs like TIA, is just database after database of enormous bits of information. The failure to connect the dots before 9/11 has led to this massive attempt now to connect every single dot. And it's really an open question as to whether or not that will, in fact, point you to the next Muhammad Atta or not. Certainly there are true believers who think that it will, and there are just as many who think that all it's doing is compromising individual liberties and not getting you any closer to the next attack.
And the changes that were made in the way that intelligence and law enforcement agencies operate in this country post 9/11, those kinds of changes, do you think that those sorts of things have in fact been positive, and will, if such a thing happens again in the future, would the FBI, the CIA, and the Justice Department, would they do a better job than they did this time around?
Well, I think there's no doubt that there have been positive steps that have been taken. The dismantling of the so-called wall that prevented prosecutors from talking to intelligence agencies has gotten high marks all around, just in terms of improved coordination. That's been one of the key steps. Greater consciousness towards aviation safety and safeguards. Those are all positive and probably long overdue steps. Will it be enough? You know, I don't think anyone knows for sure.
That's where we'll have to leave it. If you want to read the book, it's Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. It's published by Pantheon by our guest, Eric Lischblau. His last name, by the way, spelled Lichtblau. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2006 for national reporting for his stories on the NSA's wiretapping program. He works in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times covering the Justice Department. And Mr. Lischblau, thanks very much.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.